From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tighe. Today on the show, writer Michael Pollan on why the local foods movement needs a revolution in the grocery store, but also in the kitchen. Later, UWM professor Liam Callanan is a celebrity judge on a Chinese game show watched by 300 million people.
It's kind of a moving experience. We saw 40 kids, and they had beaten out, I think, 4 million other entrants, which meant they were like the 1% of 1% of 1%.
What leads to your tasty morning cup of coffee?
To be honest, I think so much of coffee, from roasting to brewing, is about looking at the chemistry of what's going on, and a lot of that is noticeable via taste.
And what we can learn today by rethinking some philosophy of old. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tighe. It's so great to have you listening today. Michael Pollan is no stranger to the murky world of food production and how we humans fit in the chain. It started with the omnivore's dilemma, in which the writer explored the farms and feedlots where our food is grown. In his latest edition, Cooked, he takes the art down to the bare bones to educate himself and the reader about the kitchen. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz met up with Pollan as he visited Milwaukee during a book tour this spring. Pollan says he's hoping the excitement he experienced rolling up his sleeves will inspire more home cooking. He calls it a healthy recipe for family, farmer, and community.
I realized at a certain point that this very exciting movement to reform American agriculture and create alternative markets and an alternative food economy was going to top out if people weren't going to cook anymore. Because the food available at the farmer's market, with the exception of the fruit, all needs to be cooked. And the great thing about this new food economy is that it is changing the proportion of the food dollar that ends up in the farmer's hands. So if you buy conventional supermarket food or processed food, 92 cents of that food dollar goes to someone other than a farmer. The person making the packages gets more than the farmer gets. But if you're shopping at the farmer's market, joining a CSA, buying local food even at your grocery store, 80, 90% of the food dollar is ending up with the farmer. So I realized this revolution was going to stop unless people cooked. And then on the other end, as I studied nutrition and saw that nutrients really don't explain a healthy diet, and nor do calories even, and that the most important thing about the diet was who's cooking it. And that was the most significant fact about your diet. You could, in effect, assure a healthy diet simply by cooking whatever you want. I mean, there's a Paula Deen exception in there somewhere, but you always need an exception that proves the rule. So the nutrients take care of themselves. You know, if you're going to cook, you're not going to make French fries for two meals a day. It's too much trouble. It's too messy. You're going to tend to buy the best ingredients you can afford and prepare them fairly simply. And that's really the key to a healthy diet. You know, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And cook it yourself.
The research went on for years, as you mentioned. When did it come to you, the way that you wanted to lay it out, the fire and the air and the water?
You know, what I do in all my writing is try to look at something in its most elemental terms. Cooking, as I looked at it, I found that there were these four transformations, and they happened to correspond to the classical elements, more or less. I did a little shoehorning. Fire is the most unreconstructed primordial kind of cooking, is basically putting meat on fire. And then there was water, which is cooking in pots, which comes much later. It's only about 10,000 years old only. But that changes everything. That gives you a whole new way of cooking. You can combine plants and meat. You lose none of the nutrients. It's incredibly economical. Whereas if you're cooking over fire, things drip in the fire and you lose all that fat and good stuff. Plus, you're softening grain. You can suddenly now eat grain, which is a big boon to humankind. And it allows you to keep old people alive because people without teeth can now eat. No, it's true. Presumably, way back then, when you lost your teeth, you were dead or close to it. And it also allows you to wean babies earlier because you've got this mush that you can prepare in pots. And then air is baking. And the technology of bread is really an important technology for the history of civilization. You can't survive on flour alone. But if you turn it into bread, you create something that you can live on. And the reason is that the baking process and the fermentation process releases all the nutrients, all the minerals, breaks down the starches in ways that make them very digestible. So it's an incredible advance. You know, it's the difference between porridge, say, and bread is night and day, because in a pot, you can only get things up to boiling point. It's as hot as it'll get. But bread creates its own pressure cooker. And in all those little balloons of air, you have steam, and you're getting up probably to 300, 400, 500 degrees. And so you can thoroughly cook the starches and make something really healthy. And then last is earth, which is what I call the transformation known as fermentation. And the reason I use earth for that is that, like the soil, it's a process of microbial breakdown. And the earliest ferments were just pits, where people dug pits, put their food in it, covered it, and you could get through the winter that way, because the fermentation is a form of preservation.
Part of the buzz that I mean, I've heard is that, egad, Michael Pollan wasn't a fabulous cook from the get-go.
I was a pretty ordinary cook, actually, from the get-go.
Give us an example of pre-alchemy.
I would make, you know, pasta. I would buy pre-made raviolis and, you know, put a little sage butter sauce on. I was very proud of that dish. But the point is, I was a very thoughtless cook. I just did it. I'm much better than I was. I can do things I could never do before. I can make bread without looking at a recipe book just from feel now. You know, I've done it enough. I can make very nice braises and things I thought were very ambitious. You know, the word mirepoix scared me for a very long time. And now I'm very comfortable with a mirepoix, which is that dice of onions and carrots and celery that we turn into the base of a, you know, French dish.
How does one encourage people to step away from the microwave or to get out of the fast food line? Where to start?
There's a lot that stands between us and cooking more than we do. We are, as a culture, outsourcing it progressively. And we're getting a very powerful marketing message telling us it's too hard, we'll do it for you, we can do it better. All I'm doing is offering a contrary narrative. It's not so hard. It's incredibly satisfying, and it has enormous benefits. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, it's pleasurable. Whether you regard cooking as drudgery or alchemy is all in your head. And we've been encouraged to think of it as drudgery, and I thought of it as drudgery. I thought chopping an onion was one of the worst ways to spend 15 minutes I could think of, you know, short of going to the dentist.
And that was because why?
Well, it's you know, it's hard to do. Peeling is difficult. The thing that and the onion's fighting back. It's making you cry. It's slippery. I mean, the whole thing just was not fun. And but as I learned what was happening, you know, and I spent a lot of time looking at the science of onions. How do they make us cry? What is that mechanism? Why are they doing it? And I learned some good knife skills from some of my teachers. And suddenly what had been this annoyance became a kind of Zen practice. And I stopped fighting it. And I started, you know, I had my little mantra, when chopping onions, just chop onions. And that's about as Buddhist as I've ever gotten. A lot of this is in our head. Now, I don't want to trivialize the real time problems people have, because they do have real time problems, and both partners are working in most households now in America, or at least 60%, I think. It is a challenge, and we have very busy lives. But there's a couple things I would encourage people to ask themselves about that. We always say we're busy, and it's automatic, and it's just kind of who we are. And we do find time, though, for things that we think are important. In the last 10 years, we found about 2 hours a day to surf the internet, do our email and everything. 2 hours that we found somewhere, because the day is still 24 hours long. We took some of it from television watching. That's gone down. And we probably took some of it from cooking. And I don't know where else, from our sleep. I don't know. But we find time to go to the gym and the yoga class, because we know it's really important to our health and our sanity. I'm just saying that spending that time in the kitchen at the end of the day is equally important to your health and your sanity.
Here in Milwaukee, and I know other cities, one of the terms thrown out there is food desert. On the other hand, we have the Will Allen Growing Power Movement. We have a growing number of community gardens. And yet there's lots of people thinking, oh, hey, how do we achieve a time when everyone has the kind of food that they can prepare in their kitchen or a kitchen? You know, how do you bridge those gaps?
Well, look, there's no question that individual choice, voting with your fork is not going to solve all the problems of the American food system. We're going to have to vote with our votes, too. We're going to need changes in policy to make good, healthy food more accessible to more people and make it more competitive with junk food. Because right now, you know, our farm subsidies support the growing of corn and soy, which are the building blocks of processed food. That's the basis of high fructose corn syrup for soda and soy oil for frying fast food in. And we're doing very little to support diversified farmers. And we're doing very little to support the growing of fresh produce. So we need to address that. But the food desert issue is a very interesting issue. And there is research suggesting that it isn't always the problem, that there are many places where there are supermarkets and the diet is still really lousy. And there's still a lot of pressure toward fast food. And by the way, there's still a lot of crap food in supermarkets. So there's no guarantee having a supermarket is going to fix your diet. And I think what we're finding is that many people in these so-called food deserts lack the skills, even when they have access to fresh produce. And it's not just poor people, it's everybody. We have a generation that wasn't taught by their parents how to cook. There are people who don't know the first thing to do with fresh produce. If you talk to people who work in food banks, you know, they're giving away a lot of processed food and maybe they should give away fresh produce. I've talked to people involved in these programs in California. They get the fresh produce into the food bank and aside from fruit, people don't know what to do with it and it rots in the refrigerator. There is a food desert problem, but there's a kitchen literacy problem too. And that I think we need, in addition to giving people access to food, we need to give them access to the skills to prepare food. And that food security depends on knowing how to cook. Nothing fancy, how to roast a chicken, how to saute some vegetables, these some really basic skills, you know, things that you could do with a knife, a cutting board, and a cast iron pan. And that we need access to those tools as well as to the fresh produce. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, we use this term fresh produce and seasonal eating and everything. One of the great things that the food industry has given us is frozen vegetables and canned vegetables. These are forms of processed food that only have one or two ingredients and are great and inexpensive. You know, we talk about the elitism of the farmer's market, and if your concern is about health, you shouldn't wait till you can get organic produce. I mean, any produce is good for you. The benefits of eating vegetables outweighs the risk of pesticide residues by an order of magnitude. So I think we have to pay attention to the food access piece and also the food skills piece, because I think they're very closely connected.
So are you out to change the world?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm out to change the food system, but the food system and the world overlap in a major, major way. Is central to the environmental crisis. It's central to climate change. It's central to the public health crisis. And it's the biggest part of the economy. I think we need to take control of our diet. I mean, that's kind of the implicit politics. It's a personal political message. But I found that to the extent I learned how to do things for myself, even things, you know, extreme things like brewing beer, which I learned to do in the course of this, you know, I'm not going to brew all my beer, but the fact that I know how to do it makes me feel a lot more competent, a lot more independent. And once you've learned to insource some of these, so many things that we outsource in our lives, it's very empowering. You could even bake a loaf of bread when you want to. You're able to imagine all sorts of other changes in your life. I think one of the things that's stymieing us politically is this sense of we can't imagine changing anything. We're so dependent on the world as it is and the market as it is. And that if we can build this space of competence around ourselves and do a little bit more for ourselves, I'm not saying everything, I'm not saying all the time, but almost in a ritual way, I think it suddenly opens up. You can imagine living with less fossil fuel, a lighter carbon footprint. And that feels really good. I think there's some political and even spiritual reasons to get involved in becoming a little bit more of a producer and a little bit less of a consumer.
Michael Pollan's most recent book is called Cooked. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz during a book tour earlier this year. A UWM professor's odd summer vacation serving as a celebrity judge on a Chinese game show. That story comes your way when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Like Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Reality TV shows have become a big deal in this country over the past 15 years or so, but if you think the U.S. has the market cornered, think again. UW-Milwaukee English professor Liam Callanan found himself playing a role in a reality show in China this year, and the experience was, well, he'll describe it for us, as he did in an essay published just today on the literary website Medium. Liam Callanan, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
And maybe I should say welcome back to the States, because you were in – it's been a while, but you were in China some time ago. Explain how this gig as a celebrity judge on a reality show came to be.
You know, this is something I do every summer, appear on celebrity reality shows in foreign countries, but actually it's not. This summer, it was a very exciting opportunity that came up when UWM, which has been working very hard to recruit students from China, had an opportunity to be part of this show that would expose the UWM brand and name to millions of people. In fact, I think over 330 million viewers of the show that I was on, which was to determine the best English-speaking child in China.
And 330 million viewers is, if I'm not mistaken, and I think you write this, more than watch the Super Bowl in this country.
Yes, more Chinese watch this show than Americans watch the Super Bowl, which was something when I got up there and introduced myself and introduced the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And told everyone that Milwaukee had great weather, because we have been told by our Chinese partners that a lot of people are concerned about the weather here. So there are at least 300 million people now who think that Milwaukee is a little bit like Milwaukee. That's assuming that I pronounced my Chinese correctly, which I'm not sure. I did not learn that much Chinese, but I did learn how to say Milwaukee has great weather. And then, of course, I didn't have to learn too much more than that, because the show was about finding the best English speaker. It was an amazing experience. And it was something that was really hard to capture on the page. But in this piece that I wrote for Medium, I just tried to somehow capture all the kind of a 360 vision of what I was involved in, in part because the people around me the whole time kept saying, like, you're a writer. You must just be blown away by this experience. It must be really so wonderful to have the opportunity to write about it. And the more that I was there, the more it kind of went beyond what I even thought I could capture with words.
And there is, to be sure, a great deal of absurdity that surrounds this entire experience.
An immense deal of absurdity. From start to finish, when I landed at the airport and they were holding up a sign that said, "Welcome celebrity guest judge Liam Callanan," that was funny enough. But then the sign next to that said, "Welcome celebrity guest judge Paul Newman." And I thought, oh, dear, because for one thing, Newman was spelled wrong and he's also no longer with us. So I thought this show is about to get really strange. And it did. And Paul turned out to be a perfectly nice and actually living person who showed up from Queens, New York. But when we got there, I was expecting something very rinky-dink with card tables and giant lollipop microphones. This was higher tech than anything I've seen on American TV. And it was located in a bright orange castle that was actually the home of the Agriculture and Military Channel, a 24/7 channel.
And you included that detail. I almost thought you had been making that up.
No, there are 12 state-run channels in China. And the show that I was on was going to be air on another network, the Education Channel. Channel 1 is for news, kind of like BBC 1. And actually, the Washington correspondent of Channel 1, Chinese state television, she won this contest previously. So, no, we were in the Agriculture and Military Channel, and there was a giant photo of the agriculture newscasting team as we came in. I didn't see anything about the military team. And the studio itself looked beautiful from the outside, but like much of China, also seemed to be a work in progress. There was some construction debris, but we just kind of stepped around that and then scooted inside, and then the magic started.
Well, and so talk about your role. You were a celebrity judge, but you make a distinction in this piece that you were a celebrity judge, but there were also a panel of real judges.
Yes, and that was definitely a big surprise for me. When I got there, I thought they had said it was going to be a four-judge panel with three Chinese celebrities and then an American. And so I thought, well, here I go. And I got my swiveling practicing in. You know, I sat at home and swiveled as much as I could in my chair. But then when I got there, it turned out the three Chinese celebrities were going to sit in the middle of the stage. And then almost a dozen of us foreign celebrities kind of sat in this foreign judge bullpen off to the left. And the Chinese celebrities, who included a comedian who had grown up or lived in Seattle for quite some time, an anchor from the Education Channel, and then this really interesting woman who was a young woman out of Columbia University in New York City. And I was told by my translator that she was a diver. And I thought, I asked her, like Jacques Cousteau? And there was kind of a pause. And then they said, yes. And so for much of the show, I thought that she was kind of an aquanaut. And then I learned later on that, no, she actually had been a participant on another reality show, which was Celebrity Splash China, which were people who jump off of platform diving.
So like what might be called, so you think you can dive.
Exactly. So you think you can dive. So she was one of the other judges. And we could never really talk to the main Chinese celebrity judges, because although I didn't know any of them, they were so famous that they kind of had like a force field around them that kind of prevented you from going up and just saying like, hey, how did that dive go? And we were on completely separate like little tiers. But it was interesting. They obviously spoke Chinese, all of them, and English. And I speak very little Chinese other than Milwaukee has great weather and hello. But it was fascinating just to kind of see how they moved through it. And at first, you know, it really did seem like it was going to be just one funny moment after another. And there was a lot of fun. But it also hit home to me, not just about this show, but all these reality shows, that it's kind of a moving experience. We saw 40 kids, and they had beaten out, I think, 4 million other entrants, which meant they were like the 1% of 1% of 1%. So they were all fluent. I mean, every one of them was a winner, and certainly they all spoke English. I mean, some of them spoke English better than I do. But when they lost and they would start crying, it suddenly became very much less funny, especially for, you know, I'm a dad and I have people in the classroom, and that's just that was very awkward. And I know that it makes great television, but Lordy, that's one way to spend your summer.
Well, and it sounds like it is not that dissimilar, only with much different production values from, say, the National Spelling Bee in this country.
That's when people ask me to describe it, and I say, well, it looked like American Idol, but it kind of felt like the National Spelling Bee. And I remember a lot of people, especially our Chinese hosts over there, said, you all should have something like this in the United States. And I said, one, I don't know if we can come up with 4 million entrants for a Chinese language competition, let alone 40. But two, I just don't know if there's a television audience here where this is a firmly established show. It's more than a dozen years old. People have gone on from the show to host various channels. It launches careers in China. Once you've won this thing, you – and not just you, but your family and your teacher, because the teachers also came to the show. You're all quite large celebrities. And it was fascinating to think that something like this was possible there.
Well, and for China being such a global economic force, it really still speaks to what's at stake from learning English.
Absolutely. There were people, the amount of English that I heard spoken and just the way that English was honored throughout the country was amazing. And it was just everywhere I turned, we talked about English. In the cab ride from the airport, a graduate student from their foreign language university came to pick me up. And within 5 minutes of hopping in that cab, we were having this pretty deep conversation about Toni Morrison's novel Sula, which is not one that everyone reads. And she had this fascinating analysis of the characters as foils. And we talked about, you know, where they lived. And I thought, my goodness, this is not a conversation I have in many cabs in the United States, let alone China, let alone in just perfect English. One day I went for a run in a nearby campus, and I thought people were calling out to me as I ran by, but because they were speaking English. And then I slowed down and I realized actually they were kind of each standing next to a tree and they were practicing their monologues for what must have been an English language exam later on that day. So wherever you looked, there were people who were looking to learn English, celebrating English, looking to demonstrate your English. It was almost like linguistic mugging. People would come up to you and say, hello, it is a beautiful day here. You are handsome, you know, and so – and it was just fascinating to kind of want to react to that.
Well, and so if you were not on the actual three-judge panel, you were in this bullpen, what was your role?
Our role was to critique the contestants who didn't go on. I kind of deliver a verbal hug as they left, because the winners exited stage left and there were much fireworks. In fact, they played Katy Perry's Fairy Work. And then if they lost, they played Skylar Grey, Diddy Money's I'm Coming Home. I won't sing it, but it was very, you know, the screens would all go gray and the kind of this acid rain would fall. And then they would come over to the foreign judges because the Chinese judges had just dissed them basically. And then they would come over to us. And if we liked them, we would hit a little light, and then we would say a couple things about them. And
this is the pillar between your legs?
Yes. There was a giant glowing pillar between my legs, which was topped with a really big yellow button. And I could not keep from hitting that button. I mean, I think there's just something about – there's a four-year-old boy in all of us. I mean, you see like a big button like that, you really want to smack it. And so I did. And also because I liked all the kids. And so I kind of set a record on the show as being – the person who hit the button for every single child. But as I pointed out to my fellow judges and actually the Chinese judges at one point, they all spoke perfect English. I wasn't sure why other people weren't hitting the button. And in some cases, they all had to do a talent, like they had to do a monologue and then they had to perform something, nunchucks or karate or guitar. Or one kid did a comedy act, which really fell flat. But I still hit my button. And I told them that I thought it was, you know, really interesting existential comedy. And they reminded me of Samuel Beckett. And which actually that rocked the Chinese judges back on their heels. And they said, whoa, we got to step up our game. And I was like, and how? Here we go. But he was great. The child was great. And so when they came over to our place, I would tell them, not only were you great, but you would be particularly great if you one day applied to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And the tricky thing was that some of them were too young. Most of the ones I saw were too young to come. So I couldn't really tell an 8-year-old, you know, we'll see you next year. Although, honestly, many of them had language skills that, you know, they would do really well in their classrooms. But I think we definitely – we raised Wisconsin's profile over there.
The essay you've written about it is in maybe an uncommon medium. Tell us about how you got onto this site called Medium.
The Medium is this new medium. It's kind of a curated literary and art space on the internet that's seeking to be a kind of a new storytelling space and very much designed to be a new medium. It's been launched by some of the co-founders of Twitter, and now they're going on to their next thing. And it's this, which it's not quite a magazine. It's a place where different stories get told and different. It brings readers and writers together. And different editors curate different parts of it. And the part that I'm appearing in is called Open Ticket, and it's curated by a talented editor named Lizzie Skernick. She has a line of books called Lizzie Skernick Books, but also appears in NPR as a book reviewer. But she always has an eye out for interesting stories, and this one struck her eye. And so I work with her on putting it together. It's an ongoing space, and it's kind of the hallmarks are lavish illustration and then a little bit of a longer read. In other words, I like the way the site honors the idea that good stories sometimes take more than 200 words to tell, or for that matter, 140 characters. So my story goes on for a little bit more than 140 characters, but then I was in China for 2 weeks. So
you probably met 140 characters while you were there.
Oh my gosh, I met close to 3.2 billion, I think, when I was over there. And it was – walking down any sidewalk was like leaving Miller Park after a game. There were just that many people. And when I walk down Downer Avenue now, I'm like, where are the other five people abreast? Not to mention – I mean, I saw somebody biking by with a sofa on the back of their bike. It's just a really crowded space.
Well, Liam, fortunately, there is always room on the airwaves for you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me. I'll answer that call anytime.
Liam Callinan teaches English at UW-Milwaukee, is the author of two novels, and this summer was called on to serve as a judge on a reality game show in China to find that country's best English speaker. You'll find a link to his essay about it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. How your morning cup of coffee might have come to taste so darn swell, it is an interesting story we'll hear when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. It's after 10 o'clock, and if you are like a good part of the Lake Effect staff, you have already graduated from your first cup of coffee today to a second, maybe even a second pot. But if you're like most of us, most of your thought goes into the drinking of coffee, and maybe as far back as the brewing, but probably not much further. But of course, there is much work that goes into picking beans, shipping them, and then roasting them well before the brewing part comes in. And for some roasters, this caffeinated bean grown continents away is scrutinized to a science. Temperatures, humidities, and soil nutrients are just a few variables that play into how a morning brew tastes. They're on the mind of Stone Creek Coffee's Christian Ott. He's the director of coffee at Stone Creek. He took Lake Effect's Nathan Royster on a tour of the company's 4th Street roasting plant and answered some questions about the sometimes confusing coffee world.
Green coffee has a shelf life of about a year. It's relatively stable. If you're keeping it in a really good environment, that's why we like this to be temperature and humidity controlled. It's very porous and it's very reactive to the environment. So if it's too dry down here, that green coffee is going to dry out. It's going to affect the way it roasts. It's not going to be the same. If it's too humid, the moisture is going to go in the green coffee. Again, it's going to affect the way it roasts. Also, if there's something else going on there, like if there's some kind of fumes leaking in, coffee's really porous. Like when you go smell perfume at a place, kind of your neutralizing element that you use is roasted coffee. Like you're smelling perfume, so you smell the coffee to clear your palate. It's very porous. It takes in any like aromas that are around. Same is true with the green. So sometimes at origin, you actually see problems where coffee is stored near like diesel trucks, and you go and you actually taste the coffee, and eventually it tastes like diesel, and that's the reason because of it. Most of this is good for about a year, like I said. So this is our production area. This is where we do all of our production, roasting, and grinding and bagging of coffee. We do everything by hand. We have a really small staff back here. It's only 4 to 5 people, so a very, very small operation. And any given week, we're roasting somewhere between 4 and 6,000 pounds of coffee, so no small amount of coffee for that. So roasting 4 or 5 days a week, getting going to the holidays now, we'll probably be roasting a bit more, a bit longer days. No two coffees are going to be exactly the same. You can't get it, like, different parts of the farm are going to be very different. So if I wanted the exact same coffee next year, it's not going to happen. It changes. It's just like wine varieties year after year. It's never exactly the same. Every single roaster is different. Every single environment is different. Every single coffee batch is going to be different. So there's no real way you can steal recipes. In terms of roasting and green sourcing, I won't say we take more care than our competitors, but I will say that we take more care than our competitors. I'm really picky about the green coffee that we buy, and I'm getting pickier every single day, spending lots and lots of time in there. I'll show you a little bit of what green sorting looks like. If there's even one major defect, I'm not going to buy it. And what that does is guarantees that the coffee coming out of the roaster is very, very consistent. During our roast process, our goal is to kind of just guide the coffee along and let it reveal itself. We're not going to try to force it anyway. We don't like doing too many dark roasts or too many light roasts. Every coffee will kind of dictate its natural place of being good. Some coffees have a couple different places, but maybe that kind of variety allows us to do really cool things with the coffee. A lot of bags of coffee in and around. We have a couple of people that are getting ready for competition. So T-Bun's in here. He's actually working on some competition espresso. Both of my barista competitors have been roasting their own coffee. So they're roasting on this little roaster right here. This roasts about 2 pounds at a time versus the one out there, which is about 100 pounds. First thing you do is you take a look at the green coffee, and it's kind of like a Where's Waldo. You need to figure out what's going on. So this is a sample I got from an importer. I won't tell you who it is. See if you can find something that's different.
My name is Christian Ott. I am the Director of Coffee and Coffee Education at Stone Creek Coffee in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
So how much coffee did you say was roasted in a single day or even a year here at the Stone Creek factory?
So we roast somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 pounds a week. So if you multiply that by about 52, and I don't have the number off the top of my head, but it's a lot of coffee.
What is the source of power energy for the roasting?
It's a natural gas roaster. The Diederich runs on natural gas, and it kind of runs similar to, it's a little bit different than your normal roasters. A lot of people use Probat, which is flame on a turning drum. The Diederich roaster kind of runs like a pizza stone, so there are ceramic tiles that the heat absorbs and then transfers from the tiles to the roaster. So the idea is you have a little bit more of a gentle heat to the roaster, so a little bit more even, consistent roast.
And when it comes to roasting, how much of it is subjective and how much of it is actual soft science?
I think it's all science, to be honest. I think so much of coffee, from roasting to brewing, is about looking at the chemistry of what's going on. And a lot of that is noticeable via taste. And if you have a trained palate, it's really easy to pick up those nuances. But what you're doing when you're roasting is you're developing the natural materials that are there. So you're developing different acids, developing different sugars. And at some point, if you're doing a dark roast, you're choosing to carbonize some of the material that's there. And every coffee is going to be a little bit different. You can't just subjectively say, I want everything to be a dark roast, because you're not going to be true to the coffee that you have.
you have to allow it to express itself. And if it wants to be a light roast and have a lot of acidity to it, when I'm cupping it initially, it'll kind of scream out to me and say, oh, be a light roast, and I'll find a profile that'll guide it there. And you need to be very careful when you're applying heat to the roaster and when you're applying air, because it'll all manipulate and change the way that the coffee tastes. I can do two roasts that are 30 seconds apart, and I might have lost 50% of the acidity that I was really looking for. So it could go from being this really awesome, like, apple crisp fruitness to just being kind of a bland, nutty flavor in a matter of 30 seconds.
And you use the term light and dark roasts, but we become kind of confused about what those different terms mean. And there's even a further spectrum of, like, from what, cinnamon to Spanish roast. I mean, can you just give us a short explanation?
The reason for all the confusion is kind of coffee's been coming from all over the place and lots of different traditions. Like, you see a lot of coffee from Europe traditionally being a very dark roast, like an Italian roast. Turkish coffee tends to be dark roasted. French coffee tends to be dark roasted. And I think it ended up that way because of the quality of coffee that was going in there. So if you have low quality coffee, if you roast it a bit darker, you tend to not notice as much of the defect or things going on with the coffee. So it becomes more uniform the darker you take it. That being said, that scale was kind of used in the Americas. We had terms like cinnamon. I don't know if you've heard of city, full city, Vienna, Italian. They end up being such a large spectrum when you're looking at the actual roast temperatures that it's not really clear. I personally don't like using the terms light, medium, and dark, because sometimes it doesn't allow a customer to try something because they think it's out of their category or things to like. And so what we do scientifically here that's a little bit different is we do everything via what's known as AgTron numbers. So when we roast the coffee, we look at both the outside, so the whole bean coffee, and we get an objective score. So it takes light and refracts it off the beans and gives us a score. The higher the number, the more light bounces back. So say I have a light roast, it might be 58 on the outside, 65 on the inside. So I go in and grind up the coffee, and I can check consistency there. And that gives me a number scale with which I can talk about. But again, every single coffee is going to taste a little bit different at a roast level. So roast levels overall, it's hard to talk about coffee when you're referring to just roast level.
So we understand, like, coffee is different roast levels, but does espresso have a certain roast profile or level that is very much espresso?
Truth is, espresso is simply the beverage you pull on an espresso machine. So it's 50 to 70 milliliters pulled over 20, 30 seconds, extracted with 9 bars of pressure with water, 195 to 205 degrees Fahrenheit, about 18 grams of coffee. And you can use any coffee that you want to. It's really the coffee beans that dictate the espresso. I feel sometimes people dark roast espresso too much, and you lose a lot of that natural flavor, that natural sweetness that really is pulled out of the espresso. Because what really is unique about espresso is the concentration in the beverage. Normal brewed coffee is somewhere between, it's about 99% solution of water, 1% coffee. Espresso is about 5% solution. So you pull about 5% into that mixture there. And so you get a heavier, more viscous beverage. And you're using the pressure from the espresso machine to make that kind of fuller tasting beverage. So you can really highlight the really awesome nuances of the espresso machine.
You're talking about all the different places you get coffee from. You have from Costa Rica and Brazil and such. Do you have them come to you to try it, or do you seek them out or have a specific farm maybe that you use?
It's really about building relationships. We built relationships with 6 or 7 different farms in Costa Rica this year, and we went there. Usually it's via someone who can take us and show us around to meet different farms. So what's really cool about Costa Rica is that there are all these what are called micro mills. Typically, you farm the coffee, you wet process the coffee, or you use your natural process on the coffee, and then you take it to a larger mill to dry mill and process the coffee. And a lot of times, the wet process actually happens at a larger mill as well. In Costa Rica, all these farms get their individual mills, so they can keep their lots very, very unique. And so we're working with partners who we have a lot from Cerro Verde. Cerro Verde is a brand new mill this year and also a brand new farm, so we're getting the first pickings from that farm. Their entire crop was 20 bags of coffee, and we bought all 20 bags of that. So it's a really cool direct relationship there.
high-quality coffee usually costs a little bit more money, but you're helping the farmer sustain and develop for the next year. And it's a long-term relationship that benefits from us. And we're continuing to look for more and more relationships like that. Like, I'll be going to Colombia in a couple weeks, and then across Central America in January, so El Salvador, Guatemala, again to Costa Rica, and East Africa sometime in the spring, to find more of those direct relationships. The more that we can find and know the people, and also the more that we can see the farm, the better we feel about the coffee.
There are a lot of misunderstandings with espresso, especially because you have cappuccinos, and you can get cappuccinos at a coffee shop like this or in a gas station where it is in a big gulp container. What is the proper kind of cappuccino?
A traditional cappuccino is a 6-ounce beverage with one shot of espresso, steamed milk, so that when the milk separates, it's half foam, half milk. We're more than happy to make any beverage for a customer, and those 20-ounce, we do sell them. But traditionally, it's in that small little container, and it's equal portions of espresso and milk, and very, very, we like to say it's a synergy of flavors. It's harmonious. It's really, really delicious. I recommend trying a 6-ounce if you haven't.
Christian Ott, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Christian Ott is the director of coffee at Milwaukee-based Stone Creek Coffee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Nathan Royster from the company's 4th Street coffee roasting facility. Reconsidering the contribution of so-called pragmatic philosophers. We'll do just that with a UWM philosophy professor when we return, just as soon as it's pragmatic. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Philosophy is a required course in many colleges and universities, but as far as studying it goes, few of us ever get beyond that basic level. But on a more basic level, we could say it's part of our everyday life, with so much tied to our philosophical views, from politics to managing our finances, how we raise our kids, criminal justice. UWM philosophy professor Robert Schwartz takes a look back at a few American philosophers of old and asks us to re-examine their ideas. They were called the pragmatists: John Dewey, William James, Charles Sanders Peirce. In his book, Rethinking Pragmatism, From William James to Contemporary Philosophy, Schwartz challenges readers to re-examine these age-old ideas and gain some current understanding, as he tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon.
The basic idea of it is that one should make sure that your inquiries are grounded in experiment, grounded in observation, grounded in reality. It's, in fact, a funny thing about current views, of, in particular in philosophy, the pragmatists are sometimes called anti-realists. In their day, they were the realists in the sense of they were realistic.
Were these three philosophers at the time, were they worried that other philosophers were just getting out of control, or they were going off on places that were just beyond any practical use?
Two things. I mean, first of all, they recognized that there were strands of pragmatism running back from ancient times. Second, they did think that the way philosophy was being practiced in many areas had sort of lost its touch with the real issues that concerned how we live. On the other hand, it's a mistake to think that they were sort of rooted in the practical everyday and eschewed the theoretical. In fact, it was the other way around. They didn't think you could make good sense out of the practical unless you brought to bear theoretical and, in general, intellectual attempts to look at the problems. On the other hand, they didn't want the intellectual to turn into a sort of scientism as opposed to science, where it was speculation. It's an interesting thing that term pragmatism in some ways has almost turned on its head the meaning, where many people in the common usage of the pragmatist view is the ends justify the means. And that was a position they excoriated, the whole idea that you could think of ends independent of the means that you took to achieve them. Then it made no sense. I mean, an example, I want to make money, but I don't want to make money by robbing someone. I don't want to make money by forging something or anything of that sort. It was always, you know, how do I get the Nobel Prize? It's I want to get it through my work, not because I killed off my competitor or paid someone off on the judges. So it was the idea that the ends justify the means, as it's sometimes put, or you're in it just to work out how to get things done, is not.
Yeah, or just the idea that it's something sensible to be done.
Yeah, I mean, I think they did want it to be sensible, right? But sensible did not mean a theoretical, non-intellectual. They wanted to distinguish intellectualism from serious intellectual endeavors.
The three pragmatists of the late 1800s, did they lose favor? They lose the battle, if you will? Or, I mean, because they kind of went under the radar and just kind of went away for a long time.
I wrote a paper called Whatever Happened to Pragmatism, in which at one time they were a dominant force, and many, in fact, think of them as the only true American philosophy, although Peirce had a lot of problems and never really had a real academic job of sorts. Both James and Dewey were not only well-known, they taught at the best universities, they had worldwide reputations. But that general approach to philosophy did sort of fall off the track for a while. But it was partly in response to logical positivism and other theories of that sort. But then maybe about 50 years later, there was a revolt against the positivist sort of analytic philosophy that really was reawakening just some of the views that the pragmatists had said 50 years earlier. But it still remained dormant, and even people who were putting forth these clearly pragmatic views never really associated themselves with it.
So they never got credit for it, basically.
They became, in fact, not what your most prominent people worked in, not what most prominent schools. When I was a student, there was practically no courses at all offered on the subject. On the other hand, I mean, Dewey, because of his work in education, he was probably the most important writer in education in the English-speaking world.
His book, Democracy in Education.
Yeah, and that still was more impact probably than any other philosophical work throughout the world, in China and Europe.
Well, your book is called Rethinking Pragmatism. I'm interested to know what it is that you think we need to re-examine from that era, what was lost, you know, what we can gain from looking back at their philosophy?
Well, part of it is, I mean, I too were not brought up in that tradition and began working on problems and working with people whose views I think fit in well with theirs, and then, you know, began to realize after a while that I was sort of speaking pragmatism and went back and found that they did have a lot of important things to say and that they predated a lot of the criticism that was being made at the time in the 60s and 70s and late 50s. Why they fell off the map is really unclear. And I mean, I think I said I wrote a paper on it and asked various people and no one really had a clear story. But the revival really came with a work of Richard Rorty called Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, in which he was an analytic philosopher, was at Princeton, and sort of said, you know, a lot of what's going on nowadays is nonsense, and the pragmatists knew that, and they wrote about it, so let's go in. My own thing is, it seems to me, not just here, but in other things I've written, that you can often get an insight to where we are today from where we came and can separate out problems that you, and this is, I think, a theme of the pragmatist, problems that made sense at the time, but no longer make sense given what we know about science, culture, humanity in general today. But a lot of academic philosophy kept going back to the as if they're dealing with the same problem. In fact, I think that was fit in with my own views of things, that these things change. It's true that there may be sort of enduring problems of philosophy in the sense, like, how do we live a good life or an ethical life? But they were stressing is there's no answer to that question that is good for all times and all cultures and things, that as we learn more about psychology and sociology, it doesn't make sense to have our old institutions, and the institutions had to evolve. Philosophy was to help make these approaches, institutions, problems more accessible to empirical study and things, as opposed to just falling in with the old dichotomies of mind, body, value, fact, is, or the whole slew of things that still today are sort of the dividing line in much of the debates in philosophy, where facts are somehow more important or at least more scientific than values, whether there's a split between the individual and society, and they were trying to sort of break down these things or at least get us to rethink what these problems amounted to in whatever context you were working in.
Is there a final maybe lesson or something that we could learn from their philosophies that would be applicable today?
Well, as I said, I don't think they have as such a philosophy as opposed to a method of inquiry, and this idea of don't accept these sort of always black and white things until you think out what is what, and maybe the divisions are not what they look like, that they're often things that put you've got to be either A or B. And a lot of their work was to say that, look, extreme A is crazy and extreme B is crazy, and there's some truth in both of them, and what you've got to do is find some way to work out what the mid-ground, but the working out had to be done in the context of what was going on at your time and things of that sort. So I think the lesson might be, you know, is just to these sort of eternal truths, supposedly, or obvious truths that we hang on to, that we, and it's either got to be true or it's got to be false, or there's the correct or the incorrect. And they were more, particularly Dewey, saying, well, think a little bit more about what's going on.
Well, Professor Robert Schwartz, thank you very much for coming on Lake Effect.
You're welcome.
Robert Schwartz is a distinguished professor of philosophy at UW-Milwaukee. He's author of the book Rethinking Pragmatism, From William James to Contemporary Philosophy, published by Wiley-Blackwell. He spoke with Dan Harmon. Philosophically and pragmatically speaking, that is going to do it for Lake Effect today. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock. Have a great day.